Hiawatha. Hiawatha was the son of the West Wind, so the poet tells us, and his young mother died when he was so small he could not remember her face. No one really knows when Hiawatha was born, but if he ever was born, his ancestors were certainly living when Henry the Navigator's pilots first saw the black men of Africa. Yes, and more than 100 years before that, when Marco Polo first saw the yellow men of Asia, and ages before that, his race, whose skin was reddish-brown, had been wandering over the vast continents of North and South America, which the white people of Europe knew nothing about. Hiawatha belonged to the Iroquois tribe, who dwelt in what is now central New York and along the St. Lawrence and the Lower Lakes. His grandmother, Old Nokomis, taught him to know the forest as the white boy knows his book, even while he was a papoose. Bound to the branch of a tree in his linden cradle, Old Nokomis crooned up to him tales of the woodlands and the marshes and the river that ran so swiftly past the wigwam. At evening, when the fireflies fluttered, she called up to him that they were setting candles in the pine trees to light him to bed. When the slow moon rose above the hilltop, she said the watchman was coming to guard him from harm all the night. If a hooting broke the silence and he lisped out shrilly, "What is that, Nokomis?" she soothed him, gently saying it was the owl and the owlets talking in their native language. Day after day he lay there in the branches. He learned all the noises of the forest. As soon as he could toddle off among the tree trunks, he found where the squirrels had their acorns and how the beavers built their lodges and what made the rabbits seem so timid. Hiawatha lived alone with Old Nokomis, but the woods were full of friends. He could answer the call of the birds, and the growls of the bear, and the howls of the wolf, and the croaks of the frog, and the high, sharp neighs of the red deer. He glided like the weasel. He ran like the bison. He raised himself high like the bear when it strikes with its paw. And these creatures soon began to know him and to love him. When Hiawatha learned to make his bow of ash wood and his oaken arrows, he shot so fast and so far that if he sent 10 arrows upward, the last one left the bowstring before the first had fallen. Yet, swiftly as he sent his arrows, he could shoot straight out before him and spring forward with such fleetness that the arrow would fall behind him. When he learned to build a boat of birch bark, with the larch tree roots to bind it, and the fir tree sap to glue it, and the quills of the porcupine stained with the juice of berries for a border, he glided up and down the river, sometimes seated, sometimes standing, trailing strings of fish behind him. A crumpled rose leaf in the current, or a twisted twig that hung above the water, often told him a long, long story. So Hiawatha really read the forest as the white boy reads his book. After a time he wandered from Nokomis to mingle with the chiefs of his clan. Through the moon of leaves and the moon of strawberries, he dwelt in the Iroquois tents. The Iroquois tribe was divided into 5 great nations. Sometimes these nations quarreled with one another, but they spoke the same language and usually went together on the warpath against hostile tribes. Iroquois who were related formed clans, sisters and brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, grandmothers, grandfathers, great-grandmothers, great-grandfathers, and second and third cousins counted too. Families in the clan, or as many as could do so, lived together in one long house built of wood and covered over with elm bark. The house was divided into rooms. Each family occupied one room. 4 rooms had 1 fire pit, where 4 families cooked their food. If I told you Hiawatha visited in a house with 5 fires, you would surely know that he was an Iroquois, and that the long house had 20 families in it. Over each house stood the totem pole of the clan. The totem pole was a kind of coat of arms with an animal for its symbol, a wolf, a bear, a tortoise, a beaver, or a red deer. In pleasant weather, the warriors did not stay long in the houses. They sped down the rivers fishing or plunged deep into the forest after game, and Hiawatha was always with them. When the stars came out, they lighted a fire of leaves and twigs with flint stones and sat around it in a circle. Then Hiawatha asked them many questions. The warriors told him that between the Rocky Mountains and the Mississippi River lived the Dakotas, who dwelt in skin tents and moved from place to place to hunt and fish. East of the Great Father of Waters and south of the Tennessee lived the Mobilians, a confederacy of many nations, the Chickasaws, who were cunning thieves, the Choctaws, who pressed their papooses' heads quite flat, the Creeks and Seminoles, far down on a gulf of the Salt Sea, who wove cloth from buffalo wool and wild hemp, and made pots from clay, and had nets called hammocks for beds, which they hung between two posts. Hiawatha asked the warriors how the Creeks and Seminoles had learned to make the pots of clay and cloth of wool and wild hemp, but they merely shook their heads for answer. What need had men of such things? There were skins in plenty for the winter, and gourds and deer horns for the water. Umph, they went around the circle. They told him about his neighbors, the Algonquins, who did not bother about pot-making. The hunting grounds of the Algonquins stretched from the Atlantic Salt Sea to the Mississippi. The Algonquins went on the warpath whenever they could. Sometimes they put on paint and feathers to go to Kentucky, the dark and bloody ground. All nations hunted in Kentucky, but no nation dared to dwell there, for the warriors always brought back many scalp locks. Some of Hiawatha's kinsmen showed long scalp locks they had taken in Kentucky. This was Creek, and that was Choctaw. These were Seminoles, and one, with feathers still stuck in it, was from a big Algonquin chieftain. The Algonquins lived in wigwams made of bark. They painted their naked bodies, and they shaved their hair except the scalp lock, which they trimmed and decked with feathers like a banner, and which they dared their foes to come and capture. These things and many others Hiawatha heard about his neighbors as he sat around the campfires. Then he went back to his wigwam, but he kept thinking over what the chiefs had told him. Among the kinsmen that came to see Nokomis was Iagoo, famous as a storyteller. Often when the air was white with moonlight, Iagoo sat alone with Hiawatha. Once he told of tribes far to the south and bordering on a great salt water. These people, said Iagoo, built stone houses with straight stone pillars like the tree trunks, carved all over with strange totems. Some of the houses were temples, where priests in long robes made sacrifices upon an altar to their god, the sun. These houses set together made great cities. There were many cities in the Southlands, said Iagoo, but Mexico, on the shore of a lake, was the greatest. Mexico was straight, broad stone paths that led to other cities. Between the cities were fields of maize, and cane was sweet sap, like the maple. There were shrubs that bore berries which were brewed for drink. There were plants that had tufts of white down like the thistles, from which the squaws made cloth, which they dyed in colors made from roots and barks. Thousands and thousands of slaves, taken in battle, worked deep in the sides of the mountains to get metals. One yellow as the buttercups, and another pale as moonbeams, which cunning artisans fashioned into necklaces and rings and wristlets. The men of the Southlands lined the walls of their temples with these metals and built their altars of them and stored the rest away in heaps in public buildings. The people who lived in Mexico were called the Aztecs. Their king, the Montezuma, was a mighty warrior. He had bows and arrows that numbered like the stars to be ready if enemies came to his kingdom. When one Montezuma died, his eldest son or oldest brother mounted the throne, which shone like the sun. It was a wonderful story Iagoo was telling. Hiawatha did not hear the owl that hooted from a nearby fir tree. When a silence fell upon the night air, he asked in a half-whisper where these people learned to build stone houses, lay stone paths, dig metals, weave cloth, and plant fine gardens of fruit and flowers. Iagoo, the great traveler and boaster, looked very wise as he sat there in the moonlight. He kept silent for a moment. Then he said, "It was tradition that ages and ages ago, a child of the sun, with skin like the snow and hair like the buttercups and eyes blue as the lake, had come to earth to teach these people in the Southlands." "And what became of the white man?" whispered Hiawatha. "He lived with them many, many summers," said Iagoo. "When they needed him no longer, he called them all together. He told them that he was going to the great hereafter, but some day another prophet would come down among them with a white face like his own." "Isa, Isa, old Iagoo, shame on you," cried Nokomis when Hiawatha told her the story. But Hiawatha could not cease his thinking, though he was always very busy. In the moon of falling leaves, he joined a fishing expedition. When the snowflakes sifted through the forest, he put on snowshoes for a great hunt, and he brought back loads of skins and dried meat. But he could not cease his thinking, though he made things ready for the warpath with his people. He helped to build a great fire in the open. He painted his face in stripes of red and yellow, put turkey feathers in his hair, borrowed from Nokomis all her beads and feathers, and tossed the finest bearskin on his shoulders. He helped to set up a red post. With the other warriors, all in paint and feathers, he marched slowly round the post. Faster and faster went the footsteps. Someone thumped upon a drum of deerskin. Loud and louder rose the chanting, until it changed to war whoops. Hiawatha struck the red post with the others. He kicked it and stabbed it, just as he intended to do to his foes. The great warrior shouted the number of scalps they had taken and the number they intended to take before they came back to their wigwams. Hiawatha had never cut a scalp lock. He could only boast how many he would take when the battle was on. When dawn broke above the treetops, he laid aside his war gear and, half naked like the others, hurried to his first real battle. The way was long. Then came blood-curdling war whoops. The ground shook with the fury of the combat. The trees swam round. The air was black with arrows. The heels hissed back the twang of bowstrings. Hiawatha shot from his quiver all his jasper-headed arrows. He kept rushing onward. He stumbled over bodies streaked with crimson. He beat and bruised about him with his war club. He did not know just what was happening till he saw himself surrounded by his clansmen, who were shouting, "Hiawatha! Hiawatha!" Then he looked and saw a string of bloody scalp locks dangling from his belt. 1, 2, 3, and up to 20. No great brave who boasted at the war dance carried half so many scalp locks. The warriors started home in triumph. One night they halted in a gully of a mountain. Fire was struck from flint stones. Game was cooked, and the warriors slept in rows before the blazing logs. All but Hiawatha, who kept thinking. He remembered the hate in his heart when he whirled around the war post. He heard again the hiss of arrows and the tumult of the battle. He felt with his fingers the long, damp scalp locks that hung at his belt. He gazed upon his kinsmen as they lay there in the firelight with their weapons and their war gear. The feuds of ages had set upon their faces deep lines which showed beneath the war paint. The fire smoldered away to soft pink coals like seashells. The noises of the forest hushed in sleep. But Hiawatha lay there with his eyes half open, thinking. Presently he arose. He trod softly through the rim of sleepers. He stepped beyond the open to a wood. He stooped and dug a hollow in the leaf mold with his scalp knife. He rose again, and one by one he smoothed the scalp locks of his foes and laid them gently in the hollow, which he then filled with leaves and bushes. Then he trod his way into the forest to the shadow of a rock where no warrior's foot had ventured. Here he built a tent and fasted 7 days and 7 nights. He prayed to the Great Spirit, not for greater skill in hunting, not for greater craft in fishing, not for triumph in the battle, but for profit of the people, how to help them live like brothers. When the days of prayer and fast were over, Hiawatha went back to old Nokomis. The braves who had come home from the battle had already told Nokomis of his prowess. She ran to meet him, shouting out her welcome. He was wan and thin and haggard, but his eyes were very bright. "Where are the scalp locks?" called Nokomis, in haste to feel them with her fingers. Hiawatha told her of his days of prayer and fasting. He said the Great Spirit had taught him how to live and toil and suffer that the Iroquois might prosper. He cleared the streams of logs and sandbars. He dried the swamps that bred diseases. He taught the use of barks and roots and herbs for sickness and the antidotes for poisons. He tilled the soil for maize, which brought forth yellow harvests so that no one need go hungry. He summoned all the nations of his language to sit with him in a council, Mohawks, Oneidas, Cayugas, Senecas, and Onondagas. He persuaded them to stop their wrangling and to smoke the pipe of peace around a campfire, 5 great nations quite united under the name of Iroquois. He painted on smooth birch bark shapes and figures which had meaning so that they might speak to one another from a distance. Life was a white circle, death was a black circle, the earth was a straight line, the sky was a bow above the straight line. When the space between was white, it meant daytime. When there were stars, it was night. A point on the right of the bow meant sunrise. A point at the top curve, midday. A point on the left meant sunset. Waving lines between the bow and straight line meant rainy weather. And so Hiawatha painted on the smooth white birch bark to preserve among the Iroquois the victories of their warriors and the adventures of their hunters and the visions of their prophets. It is tradition that Hiawatha lived for many years doing good among his people. When he saw his death approaching, he called the 5 nations to a council. He told them he must leave them, but the Great Spirit would send a race of white men in canoes of thunder from across the morning water, who would teach them how to weave and build warm houses and till the earth for grain and fruit. If they listened to these teachings, they would flourish like the leaves in springtime. But if they heeded not the white men's wisdom, they would scatter like the leaves in autumn. It will be interesting to read whether the red men in America listened to the counsel of their prophet. Of Hiawatha's farewell to his people, Longfellow says, "On the shore stood Hiawatha, turned and waved his hand at parting, launched his birch canoe for sailing, whispered to it, westward, westward, and the evening sun descending, left upon the level water one long track and trail of splendor, down whose stream, as down a river, westward, westward, Hiawatha, sailed into the dusk of evening."